Hi folks, hope you're keeping well. This is Jim Carroll saying hello again and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues of all sizes and shapes where people tell stories, talk about their lives and discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room, clean up some of the talking that goes on, and then we podcast the results. We keep a list of people we'd like to feature at Banter, and Paul Kimmage has been on that list for ages, so we're very glad to persuade him to join us at the Workman's Club in Dublin in January to talk about his life and work as part of this year's first fortnight mental health festival. He's one of the most influential and widely read sports writers in the country. He was a professional cyclist and wrote the award-winning book Rough Ride about his time on the circuit before he turned to the writing trade full-time. Paul talked to us in depth about his life as a professional cyclist, his career as a sports writer, the mental stresses and strains that occur in sport and sports writing, and, of course, the art of the interview.
First fortnight. My name is Jim Carroll. Welcome to Banter First Fortnight. Thank you all very much for coming here. I don't think this man here next to me needs much of an introduction because we all paid to see him tonight. Please give a round of applause to Paul Kimmage. Welcome, Paul. How are you?
Good, Jim, yeah.
Yeah. This is your first time in the Workman's Club?
This is my fourth time. My kids have been here. They've been at the Little Green Cars concert there before Christmas, I think it was, or a couple of months ago, but I haven't. The pleasure.
Okay, well, let's kind of like...
I'm not going to sing.
You're not going to sing? Do you play guitar?
No.
Let's start with kind of like, I suppose, I was thinking about this during the weekend. I was wondering, can you recall the first time a sportsman or a sportswoman or a sports event came along and knocked your socks off? They kind of like, it stopped, made you stop in your tracks and kind of think, this is something special.
Well, I can remember the first time a sportsman stopped me in my tracks. That would have been my father when I was 4 years old in the Phoenix Park, and he was racing around the two-mile circuit, and he was galloping down the main straight to finish, and he hit a car, and he flipped over the bonnet of the car, landed in a heap, and this massive crowd enveloped him, and peering through the legs and recognizing the old leather blue helmet he used to wear, and running back to my mother with great excitement, saying, "It's Dad." And that was my introduction to sport, really, through my father. Now, that isn't really your question. I think George Best would have been the first kind of guy that made me do commentary in my head, running around the ball in the streets, you know, that I wanted to be somewhere else other than my dad, because Dad was a huge part in growing up and who I wanted to be. But other than my father, it would have been George Best.
And I suppose then the next question is, like, I mean, what was the first time, I suppose, the blinkers fell off your eyes? The first time you realised that, like, I mean, sometimes sports isn't just what's cracked up to be?
That was obviously much later. That would have been, again, a lot of these experiences are personal, because I've had three careers. The only thing I'm actually qualified to do is plumbing. I'm a plumber.
That's interesting. I need a plumber at the moment, so I might talk about that.
Well, my rates are high. Actually, the biggest regret I ever had was leaving plumbing. I'd have been a multimillionaire now if I'd stayed during the boom times. Instead, I'm an impoverished journalist. So the only thing I'm qualified to do is plumbing. And then I was a pro cyclist, and it was through, I mean, there are two aspects there. It was through pro cycling that I discovered that the dream, the childhood dream, isn't quite what it's cracked up to be, and that there's an underbelly, a seamy underbelly that is unsavory at times. And so my first experience of that would have been about 3 months after I turned pro, and I went down to this race in Cholet in France near Nantes, just signed up with this French team, and it turned up, and of course that was 1986. At that stage France was a very much more distant country than it is now. We'd know the modern means of communication, email and all that sort of stuff. And we had to write letters. I couldn't even afford phone calls in those days. You know, the coin boxes, putting 5 franc pieces into the coin boxes was an expensive thing to do. So I used to write letters. I used to keep all my correspondence in a little briefcase. And I turned up at this race with my briefcase and my correspondence in it. note pads and letters, stuff that I write to my girlfriend, and indeed my parents, and all my teammates there, and they've all got these briefcases as well. And when they see me coming through the door, the new pro, the young guy with the briefcase, it's suddenly a source of great mirth to them, and they start laughing. And I didn't get the joke until later that night, and I'm sharing a room with one of them, and I opened my briefcase, and I see all the letters and stuff there. He opens his briefcase and it's a mini pharmacy. So he's got syringes, pills, all the things you knew you needed in the business of pro cycling to do your job properly. So that was the moment I realised that it wasn't quite what it had been cracked up to be. But,
I mean, you've covered this ground like extensively in Rough Ride. You know that like in terms of books, it's fantastic. It reminded me enough of kind of like being only a game by Emma Dunphy, much better written. And like is that view like giving the outsiders a view of what was going on. You know,
I'd say it that they're very similar in ways that they're raw. I mean, I think that's the power of both of them. That they're raw. I've looked at it, Rough Ride, it was years, I'd say, for about 10 years, I couldn't bear to even open it. And now I've dipped in and out, and I kind of go, oh, Jesus, oh, that sentence, no, or, oh, the English, oh. But it is what it is. It's raw, and it's passionate, and it was about someone I was at that time, a person I was at that time, a pro bike rider. It was a pro bike rider story, and it still is. And that's the power of it, and that's the power, I think, of Eamon's book. I mean, you compare Only a Game to A Strange Kind of Glory, the Manchester United, the Busby book, which is just a fantastic piece of work. And you wouldn't believe they're written by the same guy. People would probably say the same about Rough Ride and the last book I did on Matt Hansen, Engage. I mean, so you wouldn't believe they were actually written by the same guy. And that's absolutely fine. Because in some ways they weren't.
I mean, of course, because you were coming off your experiences on the circuit. I mean, it was as you say, it was quite raw. There was kind of like a passion there as well. It was almost like this was a love story in that you'd fallen out of love with someone.
It was a love story, and it was setting out to do something, to correct something that was inherently wrong with the sport and with my sport. So there was a drive there to try and correct this, what I saw as something that could be corrected, something that needed to be addressed. So it had that passion to it. And people have always misunderstood that, and have misunderstood me, I would say, and the difference between anger and passion. And they see me and they hear me, and they say, oh, he's an angry little bastard. He's always fucking giving it. And, you know, I understand that. I would always argue it's not anger, it's actually passion. Certainly with regard to cycling, very, very passionate about this problem and about the doping problem in sport, because I witness it firsthand. I witnessed the ambivalence to it among the sporting authorities and their complete refusal to address it and to try and correct it. And I suppose the kind of anger in the way to try and do something about that.
I mean, there's a quote there from that recent podcast you did with Eamon Dunphy, like, I didn't set up to destroy cycling, I set up to actually help it, you know? And, like, I know kind of people kind of think, oh, that's quite funny, but no, I mean, you had that passion, you wanted to kind of, like, sort it out.
I never understood that. I mean, that was the thing when it was published that was thrown at me. Well, he's, you know, he's never any good, and he's just setting out to tarnish our heroes. And my attitude has always been, look, doping and drugs and sport is a cancer, and if you love something, you don't allow that cancer to prosper. You address it, and the way you address it is to do what I did. Now, for me, that's what love is. That's what, if you really love something, then you can't see something that's eating away at the core of it and ignore that, because that's not love. And yet, that's the way that we look at it. You know, it's very, really frustrating.
It also kind of struck me as well, Paul, that, like, I mean, the way you were treated by kind of the sports authorities, the way they kind of like talked about you, it was endemic in many ways of the way Ireland acts in general, you know? That, like, I mean, it's a case of, like, I mean, keep your head down, know your place, like, ostrich-like, you know?
We've seen it with regard to whistleblowers and the way they've been treated, you know, and it's exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same thing, and, you know, what's wrong with us that, you know, we react in that quality of reacting that way to people who are just being honest and trying to change things. It's exactly the same thing.
Okay, so like you said earlier on, then you treat careers. You were the plumber, then you were the pro cyclist, and then you were the writer, the journalist. So I'm curious about the process by which you kind of became a journalist and decided this is for you. Obviously, you wrote Rough Drive, got a great reaction. Did you enjoy the writing? I mean, we were talking earlier on there, we were talking about the McElroy interview, and you said you're in the middle of kind of transcribing for the second part next Sunday, you know? And we know that, journalism can be kind of like a dirty kind of like trade. It's a trade that's an awful lot of kind of like sort of repetitive kind of tasks. But, I'm curious about from your point of view, when you decided you want to be a journalist full-time, what attracted you? Was it romantic as well?
Well, not at all. It was I had extreme good fortune in 1982 to chase this girl into the Phoenix Park after a bike race. Her brother was riding the Ross Talton, and I'd had my eye on her for a while, and she had covered the race. So I was in the Ironman racing that week. I come home on the Sunday, raced up to Phoenix Park, sit at the end of the Ross, knowing or thinking, hoping she'd be there because her brother was riding the Ross Talton, and she'd spent the week, give you a sense of how things have changed, taking notes for the journalist in the car who was working for the Irish Press. That was a way of getting around the race so she could follow her brother out. And that journalist was David Walsh. This is 1982, so now there I meet, my wife, who's thankfully still my wife. I meet the man who would turn out to be the closest friend I had and who would introduce me to this, what I still regard as a great profession of journalism. So that was the break that I had. My second break was in my last year as a pro, when I started writing these columns for the Sunday Tribune, was that I happened to be writing them for a newspaper that had an editor who wasn't fixed on the idea that all his journalists had to have spent 4 years in college and had to have degrees. He saw this guy, Kimmich, who he thought could write, and he made him an offer, and he said, I have a job here for you if you want to stop that, this cycle there. And I spent about 2 weeks thinking about it and decided I was going to take that offer. So I started in February of 1990. I had just written Rough Ride because that was the kind of transition. I needed to do this service, this one last thing for the sport before I closed that chapter and moved on, and I started as a journalist. What I did not understand at that time was that I actually had no idea what journalism was. I knew I could write, but that didn't make me a journalist. It took me 6 years, really, before I felt I understood the business and felt comfortable as a journalist. So until 1996, I didn't actually feel that comfortable at it. And the question about writing, it is torture. It has always been torture to me to sit down and write. I don't have an eyebrow in my head, but I sit down and start pulling bits out of myself. And it is murder. And I've seen guys that it comes so easy to, and I don't understand it. It is actually hell for me. It'll take me 4 hours to write a note to the milkman. That's how bad I am. I'll sit there and say, 4 points, no, move that comma there and switch it back there. It's just murder. It's really, really hard. Really hard. If someone had told me when I was writing in my last tour, in 1989, now there would be days when I'd get up from that laptop and I'd feel just as tired as I was having ridden the stage of the tour, I'd have fucking laughed at him. I said, you must be joking. But that is the reality of it. I mean, some days now, Andrews, you'd have to scrape me off the floor.
You said there, Paul, that after a rough ride, you felt you'd closed the chapter, I mean, did you really think that, or did you kind of think that you'd still be writing about these characters, these kind of exploits that happened on the tour? That were kind of I'm curious about that because when you started writing those 6 years, learned to be a journalist, whatever you were writing about, whatever you were interviewing, whatever you were kind of punditing on, surely at all stages you were thinking to yourself going back to that briefcase, there was something else in that briefcase besides those vials and those needles and the story there.
Well, there was a love still, really. I mean. And I didn't. When I say that was the last active thing that I, as a cyclist, I did for it. When I closed Rough Ride, I stopped being a bike rider. That was the last thing I did as a bike rider. I still wrote about the sport, and indeed still do. So it didn't actually end there. And, you know, I went back every year, and it's been a while now. It's been 2013 since I went back to the Tour of France, but I used to go back every year and just be, I feel that same sense of wonder about the event. As an event, it is magnificent. It's a magnificent event. And I go back after all the drugs down, and I still would feel that about it. What a magnificent event. And I remember meeting an old teammate during it about 6, 7, 8 years ago. And I remember him saying to me, you know, he says, there's actually nothing wrong with this sport that a bit of honesty couldn't sort out. And that is so true. And that is so true. But unfortunately, that's we're not there yet.
Okay, that idea of kind of honesty, you know, I mean, there's obviously things that changed since the whole Lance Armstrong thing. You know, people are a lot more, like, certainly kind of like people watching on are a lot more aware of what's going on. They can't not be anymore, right? Inside in the sport, is there kind of like, is there white hats and black hats? Are there kind of like me people who would like to be as honest as you're kind of talking about there? Or are they still kind of like me? Are they still the people in the minority?
Well, instinctively, I would say yes, but here's the problem. So you get something that's like what's just happened in England with Bradley Wiggins now, who's being exposed for having done something that he really should not have done. And you look and listen to the reaction. And where's the reaction? Who's actually addressing this and talking about it? And who's actually holding him and his team to account? None of us teammates could argue, perhaps to a small degree, but look at our guys, Dan Martin, Nicola Roach, you know, what have they said about it? The sport, that's the sport, Philippines, Murray, and that's called Omerta, and that sense of refusal to address this problem has been ingrained in the sport from the get-go, and that's the really disappointing thing. You know, you should have, and this is what really used to make me laugh, you know, and still makes me smile now. You know, over the years, Rough Riders published in 1990, and obviously the 1998 Festina scandal, the Armstrong scandal, Wiggins now, you know, every time something like this happens, phone rings, and it's RTA, Kimmich, what's wrong with Roach? Where's Kelly? Where's Nicola Roach? Where's Dan Martin? Talk to them. No, don't answer the phone. There's the problem. Now, until they do, we've no hope. Absolutely.
Okay, I'm curious about, okay, that's the players, that's the actual people who are participating in the sport.
Well, not just cycling. It's not just cycling. It's rugby.
That's
happening in rugby now. It's exactly, I'm experiencing the exact omerta, the exact same omerta that I found in cycling in rugby. And it goes through all sports, but I'm experiencing the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I interviewed Alison Wagner and Nicky Dryden a few weeks ago at the website, right? And Alison Wagner kind of finished second through an Irish woman called Michelle Smith in the Atlanta Olympics in 1996. And Nicky's a lawyer, and she's a Canadian swimmer. Just like people in the audience might know them. And Alison was kind of saying that the thing that struck her as the hardest to take was the fact that after Michelle Smith won, you know, she was looking around and she kind of expected more questions coming from kind of like journalists, but also from kind of like the audience and people who were watching as well. And instead, she said, like, she was looking at Ireland, they were colourful, this kind of like this colourful celebration of what was going on. What kind of part as well do you think kind of spectators have in what's going on?
Well, I suppose the spectators, but let's look at it in its simplest form. I know, I presume everybody here has been at work today, or most people here have been at work. And they come home, and they sit down after a hard day's work, and they flick on the TV, and they want to see Chelsea or Man United, or their favourite team, Munster, Leicester, playing a great game. They want to feel enthused by that. That's a buzz. That's a release for them. And I think a lot of people regard sport as their release, their escape from the realities of what they do, the 9-to-5 job. So they look at it in a different way to the sportsman, and they lead through the sports world.
So I do understand the mentality. They don't want bad news. Irish people did not want to be told that there were questions to be asked about Michelle Smith, that her performances were not being accepted by the swimming community, and there was a possibility she had cheated her way to the gold medal. We did not want to know about that. But that was a watershed moment for Irish people, but I do think it actually changed the way that the sports fan and indeed we look at sport now. Up until then, naively, there was this kind of an experience of myself, well, with Kelly and Rose, well, but our guys wouldn't do it. Yeah, yeah, we know. And perhaps English rugby. Yeah, yeah, we all know what's going on in France, but we have the Irish guys now. What do you think it's going on here? Well, Jesus, I mean, why wouldn't it? It's the same game, playing the same, you know, exactly the same. So that always makes me laugh. Do you think it's happening here? No, we wouldn't do anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it's a strange one, but yeah, again, the fan wants, you know, he's invested in this, and he doesn't want to hear bad news. And so I understand that.
Okay, so you mentioned rugby there, and like, I mean, you've written a lot lately about like rugby, and you've kind of faced the backlash from like Jamie Heasley even blocked you on Twitter. The modern kind of like a punch in the face. You know, it's
I think every day.
I'm curious though about like, you know, this omerta. You know, surely there are parents out there, Paul, who like, I mean, are looking at what's going on. Like, I mean, and hear these stories. We're looking at their kids and kind of realizing that this is a game which there's dangerous tackles left, right, centre. This is a game where concussion is kind of like rife. And like now there's steroids as well. You know, I'm just kind of wondering, like, is it a case in case of rugby in Ireland, that like a stop sign may come sooner than we think?
Well, it is coming. And I think if you were to speak to the parent of any young lad playing rugby, they would have concerns about the way the game was going. As far as concussion is concerned, and indeed those other issues we've mentioned. But, you know, you mentioned Cian Healy. I mean, just think about that for a moment, right? So you've got this journalist on TV who comes on and he's talking about a former French international player who has raised some very legitimate concerns about not doping, but the medicalisation of sport. Okay? And he's making a very intelligent argument as to what's being used, why it's being used, and where the game is going. And Cian Healy's reaction to this is not to say, well, hold on, Paul, pick up the phone here, let's have a chat about this, let me show you what's happening in Leinster, I'll tell you all the stuff we do here. His action is, I'm going to block this asshole. You know, and where, you know, I'm just trying to get around the mentality of that. Because again, I'm not saying, and this is the thing, Kimmy's eyes on his high arse again, he's got to give Ruby a good kicking. You know, that isn't the objective here. It's to make the sport better for Cian Healy and for Cian Healy's son and grandson and all the next generations that are coming out, so that, you know, they can actually have a go at this wonderful, and it is a wonderful sport. I mean, I really enjoy, and I've always enjoyed rugby and the commitment of the players to play the game. And it's phenomenal. It's actually what draws us to it, you know, the intense and superb commitment they have and the bravery of it. So I'm a fan, and I'm, you know, but as a journalist, you see these problems, and what do they want me to do? Ignore it. Forget about this guy. That's not how you solve anything. And bottom line, that isn't my job. It is not my job to be popular. I mean, if I want to be popular, I'd be with Dez on Dancing with the Stars. That's not my job. That's not the job of a journalist. I see it. I was on radio last night, and I'm asked about nationality and you know, players playing for him and what qualifies. I mean, you see it in what's happening. And, you know, CJ Stander came up. Now, listen, I have nothing against CJ. He's a fantastic player. I watched him play for Munster last week on Saturday against Racing. He put a brilliant performance in. You know, great guy. I can't sing the national anthem, but he can sing it, right? But that's not the issue here for me. The issue for me is, what do we want? What sort of Ireland team do we want? Do we want a team of kids who were born here, or whose father was born here, or who've come from Syria or wherever it is, and have integrated rugby here and have decided to play rugby? Do we want an Irish team with people like that, Or do we want professional players who play for other countries, who've come here and played here for 3 years with a different jersey on and said, oh, Jesus, a few quid play for us, I'll take the green jersey. What do we want? I don't want to see 50 of those guys playing for us, but that's the way the game is going. And it's not CJ Stammer's fault, it's the people who should be, who are policing it and who are governing it. And the bit that really makes me, like, I go on Twitter today and I'm getting hammered. Luke Fitzgerald said the exact same thing and there isn't a word about it. Now, riddle me that, for God's sake. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Luke Fitzgerald said the exact same thing. And I think there are a lot of international players and a lot of people in the game who feel the same way, but they won't say it. And the people are getting abused. Why don't they rugby people? I need their fans. I need their guys who go home and look at the point. They want to sit down and they want to see us winning. And guys like CJ Stanley are going to help us win. And that's the bottom line.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line. I'm sorry, it's not for me.
You said there a few minutes ago that it's not the job of a journalist to be popular. It's not the job of a journalist to be liked in any way, shape, or form. I'm curious about, like, I mean, the people you interview. You know, I mean, I've read a lot of the interviews you've done recently. There was a great interview with Jim McGuinness. There's a Martin O'Neill piece. Obviously, the Rory piece as well. And it kind of, I've seen about a quote that Vincent Hogan gave me a while back, and he was kind of saying that, like, when he goes into an interview, he wants to be liked. There's a human nature thing of wanting to be liked. You know, does Paul Kimmage want to be liked?
Absolutely. I absolutely do want to be liked. I would be lying if I was sitting here to say that the abuse I get on Twitter and across various platforms is what I offered up. It is not. It's hurtful. But as I said, that's not my job. And I'm not gonna sell out it to be popular. I think that would be just wrong. I just won't do it. But no, absolutely, I do. I do absolutely. But it's not my job.
A couple of questions on the back of that then, Paul. I mean, like, you know, first thing to do with kind of, like, say your peers. Do you think enough of your peers, like, you know, sell their soul for access, you know? I often kind of wonder about that. When you look at people across the, in the press box, whenever you go into the press box, do you sometimes kind of go, for fuck's sake, man, shape up. Ask some harder questions.
Well, you know, I would have been more critical of that. I was a bit younger and a bit more understanding now of the... I mean, a lot of these journalists are getting absolutely hammered by editors back in the desk who just want copy, any copy, it doesn't matter what it is. And they're just, you know, doing a job. Look, you know, I find it difficult to criticise those guys. With regard to access, you know, there's always a compromise. There's always a compromise. And certainly in someone like me, because I am essentially a features writer, an interviewer, and I need access. So it's always a compromise to be made in terms of, you know, at what stage do you compromise your access? Now, I don't believe I do, but I understand that. I mean, I do understand that. I mean, you know, I've gone out and had dinner with Paddy Carrington and with a lot of the people I interview, and it could be argued that I am, by doing that, I am compromising myself. Perhaps, I don't know.
What would you define as compromising?
Compromising for me is copy approval. We'll sit down now, we'll do this interview, you will give me the copy and I will approve it before it goes in. No way.
Does that happen much in sports?
It used to a lot.
I'm just kind of wondering, because I mean, most interviews I read with most sports people, there's just kind of quotes that are just off the top of their heads, they're not exactly very deep. So
Well, what's happening now, Jim, as you know, is that, you know, getting any kind of access is everything now is press conferences. It's like, this is terrible. It's, you know, you bring the player in, they sit him down for 15 minutes, he's got 100 guys in the room, and the quotes are regurgitated and everybody gets the same access. Now, I play a long game. The interview at Rory McIlroy, people have no idea what that took.
Oh, tell us what it took.
I can't tell you yet. I'd have to kill you.
I'd be compromising myself.
I just know from that quote you had on.
Well, I mean, it started started, let's say, about 2 years ago now, where, you know, watching Roddy from afar, again, being the journalist who sits in the room as just another head, he'd forgotten that we've met, quite rightly, that just rightly that we'd met when he was 14-year-old, and I'd actually one of the first people to interview him. But I was just another head in the press conference, and I remember coming home, or coming back to the office one day, and sitting down with John Green, my sports agent, and saying, look, this is, we've got to, it's like a distance. I said, my exact words were, I have got to get on Planet Rally, you know. And that meant, that started with a trip to Los Angeles last year. Well, it started before that with some other stuff, but essentially it started this time last year to Los Angeles for the Tour de Arthur tournament there, and following Rory around, and that took a lot of money, big investment for the paper, following Rory around, putting myself in his space, and making a connection. That's how it starts, making a connection. And you don't make a connection in the press conference, and you don't make a connection by writing stuff on the internet and all this taking stuff out. You know, that's not how you do it. You've got to go there. It costs money. You've got to invest. It used to be called journalism.
Right, second question then, based on what you were saying earlier on. You were kind of saying that when the abuse hits, you know, of course you take it on board. You read it and it hits you in. I'm wondering about, like, you say, the mental stress you go through, given the opinions you have, given the kind of outspoken you are about that. I mean, have you found yourself kind of like me dealing with that in a different way? Do you think you're dealing with it in the same way you used to deal with stress when you're back, like being a pro cyclist?
It's interesting. It was a different stress. In terms of dealing with it. I probably just have a moan to Anne about it. You know, I had a moan where last night, my wife, I came home and said, Jesus, I'm back to Uber, I'm giving that up. Every time I go on, I get fucking hammered for just giving an opinion. But that's how it is. It's only my opinion. It's just my opinion. You don't agree, you're absolutely fine. But what's the problem here? You know, don't have to go on Twitter, call me an asshole, you know. You have a different opinion, fine. You know, I'm not going to ram my opinion down your throat. I'm prepared to change my opinion if you can actually tell me something. You know, I'm open to all that.
So Anne got that exact same speech from you last night?
Absolutely. And she says, look, that's your job. She's right, but I have to be reminded of that.
Yeah.
I have to be reminded of that. You know, but I'm not. It's not easy.
Are there times, though, when you react to it with something other than anger?
Other than anger? Well, one of the ways of reacting other than anger, you know, in our business, you could say, well, I'll sue that asshole, and that happens. I would never, ever do that. I don't care what anybody would say about me in print, and they've said some really nasty, particularly during the Michelle Smith times, particularly during that time. I got a real bad time from colleagues. And, you know, that was the bit that I found most objectionable. But I would never, ever do that. Absolutely not. It would just, no way. So other ways of venting other than that, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how. A good bike ride, you have a good sweat up and get rid of it. Yeah, maybe that way, yeah.
Has there been a time like when something has kind of happened and you take it on board in a much different way, this kind of sends you to a much darker place?
I was in... I think everybody is prone to the darker place. And I remember in my cycling career, at a time when things weren't going great, driving up to Belgium for some races up there, and I didn't like racing in Belgium. It didn't suit me. It was, you know, flattish and cobbles and wind and rain. And it wasn't anything I ever really enjoyed. And I was driving up to, actually was going up to spend time with Kelly for a week, racing races up there. And I was living in Grenoble at the time. And I got about three quarter ways up, pulled into this cafe. I sat there for about an hour. I said, I'm going home. I can't face this. I really can't face this. And it was probably as close as I've ever come to. I won't say a nervous breakdown, but I was in a really difficult place for those few hours. And I would be prone to that. I think we're all prone to moments like that where I'll give you the Italy example. This is a really interesting example. The Irish Times ran this fantastic series of columns with an unemployed man in, I'll tell you exactly what it was. It was in 2011, the winter of 2011. And I remember reading these columns at the time and just feeling nothing but absolute empathy for this man and thinking, oh, sweet Jesus, that ever happened to me, how would I cope? And 5 months later, in January of 2012, I think that actually did happen to me. I was sacked by the Sunday Times. And being in a really, that was a dark place when, you know, you're bigged up to be this hero and suddenly then you're shown the door. And I remember, and this is a totally irrational response to something like that. I've been at the Sunday Times for 10 years and I had all sorts of rights, all sorts of stuff done. As a staff employee, had I died, they were going to have to pay a big time and Anne and the kids would be looked after brilliantly. Then they sacked me, and there was a kind of a 4-week window where I wasn't actually sacked yet, it was going to happen at the end. I had this crazy idea, so, oh, if they actually go out and ended it now, those assholes have to pay out, and it should be sorted. It should be sorted. And I actually thought about it. I remember standing on a platform at Barbican Station one day and thinking, you know what, it should be sorted. And it was a fleeting thought, but it was definitely there. And during that time, of course, you're bringing this stress home to, you're bringing it home to Anne and to my son, Luke, and Owen, and my daughter, Evelyn. And Luke is our youngest. He would have been about 16 at the time. Of course, you know, as much as you try to shield them from the stresses of what's happening, they pick up on everything. And I remember seeing him, he just started crying. And he just started crying, and at that moment, I went over and I put my arms around him and said, son, everything is going to be okay. And I didn't care what it took, but everything would be okay. And any thought I had of doing what I had fleetingly thought of doing was gone at that stage. Because I realized for my son and for my family, it was much more important that I stuck around and thought it. And, so those were the kind of two experiences I've had with that.
I mean, it's interesting, because some of the best interviews you've done, like say something like with Colin McCarron, for example, you know, it's with sports people who kind of like been to those depths as well. And I often kind of feel that, like, when you're reading an interview with someone like that, and they're talking, as you just kind of talking, that kind of raw, human, very personal, very emotional kind of stage, it's like you're seeing something more than just kind of like what we see on the pitch, way more.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we're all vulnerable, and we all need help. And, you know, when someone gets knocked down, and I mean knocked down in the, they've had a setback. When they decide, you know, it takes so much courage to stand up again. And when they decide to do that, and you look at the Karam and what happened to him and that gambling addiction and what it drove him to, you know, and for him to come back and put on that Tyrone jersey and face the ridicule and abuse that he got, you know, that takes unbelievable courage. Unbelievable courage. And how can you not just extend the hand and an arm and say, well done, come back, you know? And that's really important. Yeah.
In terms of kind of, I mean, the interviews you've done, you know, obviously the Rory thing is a big one for you, because I mean, I get the feeling that for the only wine snob in Coolock, you've come out of a golf nut of late, you know, so that's obviously a big one. But what other interviews kind of stand out for you? And what are the ones on the wish list?
I've been very fortunate, Jim. I mentioned the Sunday Times there. I'd spent 10 years in Ireland, 12 years in Ireland, before I went to London, and then I spent 10 years in London. And they had obviously a great budget and enabled me to interview some great stars, Pete Sampras, Jimmy Connors, guys I'd idolise as kids, Sandy Connors, Joe Namath, American icon Joe Namath. What a story. I remember going to Florida to sit down with Joe Namath, someone who'd spent time with Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and the Rat Pack, and to tell stories about that. God, brilliant, you know. So really fortunate that I've had the chance to spend time with people like that. But you know, you meet someone like, John Kavanagh, Conor McGregor's coach. And I've come out of spending a couple of hours with John feeling the same kind of buzz as I had with John. It's a great interview, it's a great insight, clever man, really interesting man, and a chance to translate that then onto a newspaper page. The buzz is the same, really.
Yeah.
The personality is great, and there is definitely a buzz from the name. Really, there are lesser people who would give me the same voice, but have really powerful stories to tell, and I would feel as excited, if not more excited, writing about them as I would about the big guys. So it's been nice to have both.
You mentioned earlier on there about the fact that, like Paul, like many journalists, you won't sue another journalist. You know, you just won't go that way. But like, you know, like all journalists, you know, you're in the receiving end of an awful lot of kind of like letters. You're in the receiving end of kind of lists of letters, cases. We know the cases have been covered in depth. I'm curious about the conversations you have sometimes with, say, John Green, you know. And obviously from what you're kind of saying, there's a big support there. He's going to go to bat for you. He's going to get the money for you. But is there times, though, when, like, even he will just go, fuck it, can we, like, pull back here?
There's a time. It's every time. Yeah. You know, the business has changed. I look at what we did in 96 and with Armstrong. That will never happen again. When the newspapers are not in the business of chasing those guys anymore or pursuing that stuff anymore. I don't think that's ever going to happen again. That's a real regret. That doesn't mean that the threat of libel still isn't haunting us on a regular basis. You know, it is a regular conversation that we have, and obviously everything that we write is scanned by lawyers, and you've got to fight for it. And I've never had a problem fighting for it. I've always understood that end of the business and understood, you know, that you've got to do it right and that the stakes are really high here. It's, you know, there are times when it's extremely depressing. The truth and you can't write it. There's only anything less or anything more frustrating as a writer than that. And I've certainly had a lot of that, and still, you know, I mean, I see what's going on in England with Wiggins, and I mean, I had that before I knew that book. I just couldn't get to it. I couldn't do what Matt Lawton had done. I'd actually get it into the paper. So that's, you know, an ongoing frustration. But you know, you mentioned John, and, you know, obviously people would know me from Armstrong or for some of the stuff I've done, and they wouldn't have a clue who John Green was or who Eamonn O'Sullivan was, my previous editor at the Sunday Independent, or indeed Angus Fanning. But without the support of real editors and people like that, I'd be nothing. I wouldn't be a journalist. Vincent Brown again. So they're the real unsung heroes of the profession, you know. And you can't work without them.
Last couple of questions, Paul. Thank you so much for your time. Last one question before we get some questions from the audience. And we talked there earlier on. You were kind of vehement about rugby, you know, and like we've seen it with swimming, we've seen it with cycling, you know. I read that piece about you and Joe Brawley after kind of the All Ireland this year, you know. You did with Jim McGuinness was really, really good. And I'm kind of wondering, do you think those sports are clean? Or is it a case of you're enjoying them for what they are and you're just hoping to fuck they are clean?
I don't really look at it with that eye. I mean, number one, if you look at football, Monaghan, young Monaghan player, last year was done for steroids. So, you know, there's an example of why the game needs to be very mindful that, you know, while there is an amateur game, that there are still players out there who will be prepared to cross the line and to bulk up for whatever reason and take this stuff. So they've got to be really focused on not getting complacent about that. In terms of my work, I've gone to Croke Park a fair bit now this year and really enjoyed a lot of the games there. I think this answers the question. So, a couple of months ago, this guy gets in touch. I have a story. I know Dublin at Blood Dope. Okay, let's meet. We meet at a place in town. We sit down. Okay, what have you got? Well, I've got this guy from the inside who's told me this. Right. Who is he? I'll come back to you. Okay, I listen to you. I'm open to everything you're saying. You have got to give me something, a place where I can take this. I can't go on the paper and somebody saying, I know Blood Dublin or Blood Open, right? Now, it seems to me, you know, a long shot. I've got to be at Blood Open. I wouldn't be sure about that. But I'm prepared to listen. I'm not in any way telling this fella that I don't believe him. What I'm saying is, okay, who's the contact? I haven't heard from him. Now, I can do nothing with that, you know. I can do nothing with that. I need the guy, the source. I need him to talk to me. I need him to tell me what he's seen. I need to analyse what he's told me and say, well, is that stand up? Can I take it further? What can I go to Jim Gavel with? And that happens. I waste more and more time meeting guys like that around town. Oh, rugby, you know, great. Okay, what's the next paragraph?
Have any of those deep throats led to anything?
Actually, I would say not at all. Not at all.
Okay, but last question for me then. Again,
it doesn't mean I will always go and meet them and sit down with them, absolutely, every time.
Where did you meet them?
In what is that cafe?
Yeah.
It was the one on Nassau Street there.
In Casey Peach.
Yeah. Downstairs.
Okay.
He had a cappuccino and I had a double espresso.
Did John Green okay the expenses?
I don't think I submitted the expenses, but actually no, he paid them. Gotta be honest.
That's good for me. And thanks so much for your time, Paul. It's great fun to speak to you. And thanks so much for doing banter at Sports Fortnite. It goes back to the golf thing. I mean, I'm fascinated by like your fascination by golf.
Yeah.
Do you think what's it down to? Is it down to kind of like, you know, the myths? Is it down to like me believing it's completely clean?
Yeah, it's down to essentially it's a game of skill. That isn't to say that there isn't, if you look at the way the game has gone with the power game and being able to hit the ball long, there isn't an incentive to bulk up. And you see, Rory is, you know, he's lifting weights and stuff like that. It is essentially a game of skill. What I love about it was, I fell in love with golf in 1996 on the Sunday evening of the Masters, watching Nick Faldo come from 6 shots back to beat Norman for the Green Jacket for his 3rd Masters title in 96. And I remember watching that and thinking, wow, absolutely wow. Who would believe he could do that? That a guy could crumble like that. The mental frailty and couldn't hold out and just disintegrate. And it was actually cruel to watch. But I just thought as sport it was just brilliant. And again, I won't give Matt Cooper a hard time, but I was talking to him before Christmas and he was talking about, well, you know, your highlights of the year. And I think my highlight of the year last year was the same thing. It was Jordan Spieth at the Masters. Has won from pillar to post in 15, comes back, leads 1st round, leads 2nd round, leads 3rd round, finishes the 3rd round, a bit shaky, starts off, playing the final round, goes to the 4th 9 holes, not a wobble, he's great, and then absolutely disintegrates in the next 3 holes. I'm just saying, that is sport. You know, it's not Chris Froome riding the Tour de France like a robot. You know, takes the yellow jersey on day one. 18 meets, gone to front every day. You know, that isn't sport. It's Dublin and Kerry in the All-Ireland semi-final. Dublin were coasting. Kerry score.
Dublin are out in the team.
Half-time comes, that's it. After it doesn't come, Dublin are out of the All-Ireland. That's what I love about sport. It's unpredictable. And I get so much more of that in golf than I do in a lot of other sports. That's what I love about the game.
Paul, thank you, everybody. We've got time for some questions from the audience as well. So Philip here has got a microphone. So put your hand up. We'll get the microphone to you. So don't be shy. Yep, gentleman just down there on the right-hand side.
How are you doing? This is Grace Ball, Grace here. Well, just a question I have is, you alluded to it earlier, is the medicalization of sport. And I'd just like to get your thoughts on, you know, where's the line? Because the extreme end, built open dimensions, you the likes of the club player taking treatment, and, you know, and ibuprofen to get the next match. So, what's your thought on where's the line? Because it's all blurred.
Well, the line is blurred, but I've always believed that everybody knows where it is. You just need, and I apply this to myself, in my own career as a pro bike rider, I took amphetamines 3 times. And that clearly was, even though it was for races where they were fixed, weren't actually real races, and that did influence the reasons why I did it. I would absolutely never reject the fact of being, well, you're doped, sure. Okay, now, I don't regard myself as having doped. But I do know, as part of being a clean rider, there was at least 3 occasions where I had to take caffeine in a very unpleasant manner. That was the suppository. You don't understand the glories of real sport if you've actually done that on a cold, wet day before stage this year to tell you, ram one of these things up your rear end. That's when it all comes home, that it's not all sweetness. But I understood at that moment that even though I wasn't breaking any rules, that it was wrong, that it was doping. I understood that. I was enhancing my performance with a chemical aid. I understood that. So I understood at that moment that I was doing this for performance enhancement. And I think if you ask every sportsman to justify what they're doing and why they're taking it, they can give you the exact same answer. I had this conversation with a very, very famous rugby player. We were sitting down, we were talking about the abuse of substances in the sport, and then I mentioned painkillers. And I said, well, you know, I'd heard it was routine that before every game that the Irish players got 2 painkillers. I said, oh, yeah, I did that. I said, well, well, was that not? Why were you doing it? You weren't in pain, no. So you were doing this. You know, so I said to him, but isn't sport all about the ability to manage pain? The great champions have a greater facility to deal with than the lesser guys. And he agreed with that. Said, but if you're taking this painkiller, then, you know, you're taking that out of the equation, you're lessening that, you're doing it to enhance your performance. He says, well, I've never thought of it like that. He said, no, but that's the bottom line. And that is the bottom line. And you can apply that right across the sport to every substance, you know, anti-inflammatories, steroids to treat injury, you know. So I think the line is good, but actually guys actually do know what they're doing, and you actually understand it. Yeah.
Next question, just get your hand up, we'll get you. Microphone to you. I'm really sorry for this. I can't see a thing. So if I call someone, I call someone by the wrong gender, it's not deliberate. So just put your hand up and get my friend here. No? I got a question here, actually. Thanks, Philip. I'm really sorry for this. We can't see a thing up here.
Paul, I'm curious because I know a guy who worked with Paparazzo in the States, and he had photos of Tiger Woods having an affair, and the story got spiked because Tiger agreed to do cover stories for Golf World.
Oh yes, it was actually National Inquiry.
And I know the guy, and so I'm wondering, have you ever had a story spiked? Do you know of stories been spiked?
Well, I've had stories spiked for legal reasons, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I've had, when I did that press conference with Armstrong in 09, the Sunday Times wouldn't actually let me to write anything about it. And I've had a lot of those times when I've written stuff that the lawyers have said no, or the editor have said no. I'm not sure, with regard to photographs, if that's the same. The same issue. I don't think it is really. I mean, your photograph of Tiger Woods and lifting the ball in the rough, I'd say, as a sports photographer, that's again, you know, whether, you know, his private life is, I would probably say not.
That's it, thank you.
Yep, gentlemen here in the front row.
House of cards is falling around soccer when you've got a former Ballon d'Or winner lying in a bed with a blood bag in his arm before he went to cup final. You've got the evidence there. You've got Samer Nasri tweeting about getting a lovely old
league.
Yep.
Money.
A governing body that is itself totally corrupted by money and has no interest in addressing it. Teammates of guys who would have witnessed that, who are so well paid that they wouldn't ever dream of even, you know, trying to bring that story to a journalist, that a journalist could take it forward. Journalists who wouldn't even dream of addressing that in the sport because, you know, that's not what the fans want, that's not where the boss wants. You know, actually, I went up in Liverpool Spurs game and it struck me this year at White Hart Lane. But Luke, unfortunately, is afflicted with the addiction of being, or the affliction rather of being a Liverpool fan. So he went over to the Spurs Liverpool game at White Hart Lane. And it struck me standing in among the Liverpool supporters, and this is not in any way a reflection of Liverpool, Liverpool felt the same with the Spurs supporters, but it struck me that the 22 players could walk out on that pitch. You know, steroids strapped to their arms, you know. And the fans would not give a damn. They would not care a whit about it. And when you've got that, you've got a governing body, you see a sport that really nobody cares about. Totally agree. It just is not going to happen. But it's as bad as anything that we've seen in other sports, absolutely. And you know, a lot of it is some of it is the governing body's, in this case, UEFA or FIFA, have seen cycling and they've seen what's happened in cycling, and they say, Jesus, we're not going there with that. We're going to manage this to make sure everybody, and it's happening rugby, but we're going to manage this in a way to give this a sense that at least we're addressing it, or in some way addressing it. And that's a new aspect of it.
Sorry, just on that one, you said if the players come out with needles sticking out of their arms, the fans will care. If the players are gay, the fans will care. Which is
Well, what's that? You know, again, it's awful, isn't it? But that's, I think that's a particular mentality. I was going to say, which would be wrong about English, but it's not. I mean, I'm sure it's the same. It's the same with guys everywhere. I really think we've been fortunate with sport here in that way. You see it in Crow Park, that the fans can go in and mingle. And actually, another highlight of my year was the Sweden-Ireland game at the Euros when a couple of days after the riots down in Marseille, when the Russian fans had gone crazy and the English fans were going crazy, that, you know, the Irish fans could go there and mingle with the Swedes, and it was sport as it should be, you know, in terms of the generosity of each set of fans to each other. I just thought it was fantastic, a great reflection on the country and on the people that we were like that, yeah.
Yeah, but just to kind of follow up on what he's kind of the question was there about, like, I mean, say, if a player was gay, I mean, like, I remember, like, Donald Cusack, to Ogle Cusack talking about, like, the abuse he got from the terrorists when he was playing for Cork, you know, there's elements of it there still.
I would say that those people were in a minority, the vast majority of people wouldn't have reacted like that. I think that would be the case, I would hope.
Is a question more here, sir?
Yeah. I think you mentioned in the After Ball Sunday review back in May about that it was around the Leicester City.
Don't start holding me to account.
It was the Leicester City loving at the time, I think. And you reference, I remember reading an article in the BBC about Leicester and their sports performance, but I remember you kind of being a little taken back. You'd said that maybe somebody involved doctors that were in the Tour de France.
Well, you look at what's happening in football now, and the foreign managers now, English managers now, are totally unfashionable, and it's all, unless you're a Parigi or you're not going to get a job. And these guys have all brought in their own medical staff and their own medical people. And if you look at Paul Merson, who's not the sharpest knife in the drawer, he spoke about Wenger's time at Arsenal and, you know, being told to turn up at the hotel in a particular time and getting this injection of this yellow liquid. He had no idea what it was. But that's all come in through the foreign coaches and the foreign medical teams. And so you've got to ask yourself, and you look at the German national team, Will Wolfhard, the team doctor there, the Bayern team doctor, and you see some of those players who get well on into their 40s and they're running like the Duracell ones, you know, and you've got to ask questions. How does this work? How does this work? So it'd be very naive to think that with these guys in place and these doctors in place, and you look at the performances, how many injuries, how are the guys playing, what are they doing, what underpins the reason they're as good as they are, you know, great endurance, ability to run for 90 minutes, the Barcelona team, you know. Look, join the dots. You look at the famous drug bust in Spain, Operation Puerto, and it was only the cyclists they busted there. You know, there was footballers involved there, and all those guys have been protected and tuned, and it was only the cyclists. So, look, you'd have to ask questions about it.
Thank you very much. Time for one more question? Or two more questions. Yeah, one here, and Brian, and Stephen.
Just in light of golf being in the Olympics, tell me one sport that should have actually been in the Olympics. Oh, and also, you know, Rory McIlroy deciding not to do the Olympics because, quote, Astrid's going to look at.
I don't think that's why he decided he wasn't going. I'm not going to tell you any sport that shouldn't be in the Olympics because I don't know. I haven't even thought about it. I will tell you that I hate the Olympics. I hate everything it stands for. I ran off the beach this year. I haven't been to an Olympics since Sydney in 2000 and had ample opportunity to cover everyone since. It is the absolute horror of my life to actually go there and try and do any of that again. It represents everything I hate about sport. A corrupt body, the IOC, screwing the whole city, I could go further. I may never. I'll get myself in trouble. But I ran off the beach. Having said that, I ran off the beach this year to watch Sinead Jennings and Claire Lamb in their heats and in the final of the Royal Final and the O'Donovan brothers. Because I think Sinead Jennings, or Sinead Lynch, as she is now, is just a phenomenal person and represents everything that the Olympics should be. You know, you look at the sports council here, and I hate it. But, you know, you get everything is performance-based. What was wrong? What is wrong with getting our best athletes, our national champions across the disciplines, and saying, right, you're the best we have, you're going to the Olympics. I don't care if you've only got the C standard or the Z standard. You're the best we have. Being an Olympian means something. We don't care you go. We don't want you to. We're not interested in the medal table or you winning medals. You're our best. Being an Olympian used to mean something. That actually was important. I still got an Olympic blazer I was given in 1984 and I sent it home in the press. That actually, at that time, in 19, that was really important for me to be an Olympian. That doesn't matter anymore. Unless you go there and win a medal, it's as if, you know, you don't count. You don't matter. So I'm not going to tell you what shouldn't be there. I will tell you that Rory McIlroy went for reasons that are very difficult for us as Southerners to explain, and that it wasn't the reason you described. But over and above that, I really don't. I'm not going to say what should be. I'm not too bothered about it.
Last question from Stephen.
Paul, you mentioned, you kind of spoke that the one thing that you wouldn't compromise on is copy approval. For understandable reasons. Is it difficult, though, to let that kind of principle slide when you're writing a biography?
Well, it's a an autobiography, yeah, if you're working with somebody. A biography is, I've never met you, you don't know who I am, but I'm going to write a book about you. I'm just going to talk to all your friends and I'm going to sit down and I'm going to expose all of your bad habits and I'm going to publish a book. A biography, so what's your name?
Steve.
But a biography of Steve by Paul Kimmy. So we don't have to meet for me to go and do that and expose you as a corrupt man.
I'll give you all the stories, don't worry about that.
An autobiography, which I think is what you're talking about, is when we collaborate. So I meet a sportsman, we sit down, and he pays me a fee to ghost his book. That's an autobiography. That is, once from the moment you sign that contract, that is all about copy approval, because it's not your book, it's his book. So whatever he wants to write is what will appear, because it's his story. Now, that doesn't mean that we're sitting down and I won't fight as his ghostwriter to say, no, that has to go in. You must put that in. And we won't have a big argument over it. Now, ultimately, if he doesn't want it in, it ain't going in. So in that way, from the moment you sign up as a ghostwriter, you totally sign away your rights to copy approval. You're giving, that is totally about copy approval.
But that must be extremely frustrating then for you.
It was frustrating once. The book never saw the... actually, that isn't true. You know, that isn't actually true. We never actually got to that phase. So I've ghostwritten...
Engage
with Matt Hampson. Cascarino. Tony Cascarino, Secret Love, Tony Cascarino, and I did an awful, awful sports diary, or World Cup diary with Andy Townsend, back in 1994. And I had great relationships with all of them, and I embarked on the project with, which I think you're probably referring to, Brian. Brian O'Driscoll, that went swimmingly well until we had a disagreement over, actually it was about an interview that I wanted to give for the paper. So we never actually got down to the nitty-gritty of putting in or having those arguments about what I thought he should say and what he'd rather he didn't say. But that's the essence of it is that once you sign up as a ghostwriter, then you that's out of your control.
But you go beyond the normal kind of ghostwriters, Paul. I mean, you describe yourself as kind of the Dan Day-Lewis of ghostwriters.
In the sense that I don't know any other ghostwriters who wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, just in sweat, I think, oh, that's got to go, or we've got to go this, or this is missing, or yeah. So I totally, I want to be them, you know. When I, the book I'm most proud of is Engage, the book I wrote with Matt Hampson, a 20-year-old English rugby prop who was catastrophically injured. And I'm actually almost twice Matt's age, and I met him for the first time, and I had actually no concept of what it was like to be 20 years old and not be able to move from the neck down, you know. I wanted to understand what that was like. I needed to understand what that was like in order, I felt I needed to understand it in order to write the book, but to do him justice. And that process took 4 years, and it took me going and living with him and seeing firsthand what it took, the 3 hours it took to get him out of bed, 24/7 care he had, two people with him, 24/7, wiping and cleaning him, you know. I had to see that in order to do his story justice. So in that way, I would probably be the Daniel Day-Lewis.
Is there any kind of ghostwriting books on the horizon? Most ghostwriters describe them as a pain in the arse.
The experience with Brian wasn't great, I've got to be honest. And I think I...
No, Brian didn't describe you as a pain in the arse.
No, I wouldn't do that. He's a great rugby player. He's a very nice guy. We didn't see eye to eye over an issue. But ultimately, the experience wasn't a positive one for me, and I decided, I think after that, I wouldn't do it again. That's not to say that the difference with Brian and with Tony and with Matt and with Andy Townsend was I knew them, let the rest of the day Matt, but I knew them and I really liked them as people, really liked them. Now, when you like someone like that, you know, you want to do it for that reason. Again, that was the reason I wanted to write to Tony, who I love to this day, one of the best people I've ever met. You like them, and you do it for that reason. Now, there's every chance I'll meet someone that I really like, and I'll do it again, but it will take that. I will have to like them. I won't be in a position where, as happened with Brian, I just lost my job at the Sunday Times, and I know what. That was the reason I put that on. So, I'm not saying it won't happen again, but that will be the reason that I really like them.
Paul Kimmage, thanks a million for joining us here at Banter. Big round of applause, Paul. Thanks to Paul, thanks to First Forte, and thanks to Vinnie, Carl, and all the workmen for their hospitality and help. The Bantacast series producer is Tanya White. Join us next week for another Bantacast. We'll see you then.